Here we go. We are technically finished with the Beatitudes proper. These are blessings that begin Jesus' most famous sort of group of teachings called the Sermon on the Mount. And what we're talking about today is kind of a transition into the rest of that teaching, which is where we'll be, particularly come the spring. We'll do Advent, as we usually do, and then we'll jump back into the Sermon on the Mount. But the passage today is a bridge between the Beatitudes and the rest of the sermon. And last week, I started by talking about three errors that the church has tended to make, that Christians, that followers of Jesus have tended to make in the way that we interact with the world. And I upgraded them this week with images, which I was expecting more of like a wow or something. Okay, that's a little much. That feels... So here they are. So there's the isolationist, which is we get in our holy huddle and we want to protect ourselves from the world. And we see often that, as we were talking about last week with Blessed are the Persecuted, this is often a response historically to persecution. Sort of the idea, well, then we'll just kind of rally together, protect ourselves, build up walls, and create kind of what some call a holy huddle. There is also the conformist sort of approach to the world, which is we want to be so well liked by the world, we don't want to be seen as offensive, we don't want to be seen as the wrong type of Christians or even just the wrong type of people, and so we just kind of conform. We take our cues from the world, we become, that's a chameleon if you can't tell, right? We take on the colors of the world. Some of you just got a lesson in that. And then there's the combative, right? The put up your dukes, the sort of everything's a fight and we're itching for a fight. And persecution becomes sort of the main measure of how faithful are we being? How much doesn't the world like us? And then, yay, we're winning. And what we said last week is in Jesus, blessing those who are persecuted, we said that there's a more, I don't want to say nuanced, there's just a totally different approach that Jesus would have us take. And I think that the images that he immediately goes to here after the Beatitudes are a great, if not clue, kind of the whole picture of what Jesus would have our understanding of what our responsibility to and for the world is as his followers. So here are the two images. Let me just read these. It says, it was the last part of what Gina read. It says, you can go to that next slide, you are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Salt and light. If you're familiar with Jesus' teaching, if you're familiar with the New Testament, this is probably fairly familiar to you, this idea that we are called to be salt and light. A couple things to notice right off the bat. Notice that Jesus is saying, this is who you are if you're a follower of his. If you name the name of Jesus, if you put in your faith in him, this is what you are. He doesn't say, aspire to be this. He doesn't say, thou shalt be light and salt. He says, this is who you are. This is your whole purpose. This is why Jesus has called you to himself. This is core to your identity now. So very similar to the Beatitudes, which is, we said, have this element of aspiration, have this element of command to them, but really at the end of the day are not commands so much as just blessings that are given to us. So too is this idea, you are salt and light. Yes, something we should aspire to, and it's hard to get away from that. But notice, Jesus says, no, this is who you are. Full stop. It's an identity that's been given to us rather than one we aspire to achieve. Just like in all of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, in radical distinction. One of the ways that Christian faith is most radically different than our current cultural prevailing messages is that the identity that Jesus gives us is not one that we discover from within. It is not one that we achieve through some sort of external measure. It is one that is given to us from from the giver of all good and perfect gifts, as Rob said during the liturgy. It is given to us as a gift. You are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. So what's going on with these images? I don't know what immediately comes to mind for you, but for instance, with the salt one, there's one scholar who comes up with at least 27 different uses of salt that have been discovered in ancient times, which is to say there probably isn't just one thing going on here. There probably isn't one primary use of salt that we're supposed to somehow figure out. But salt back then was very similar to now. Salt was delicious and good for seasoning. Thanksgiving is this week, and I'm a big salt guy with Thanksgiving, right? Like, if someone asked me what's your favorite food for Thanksgiving, I would say, whatever, just salt. It's just more salt, right? It seasons everything. It makes the mashed potatoes better. It makes turkey better. It makes everything better. And that was certainly in ancient times. Maybe the one that comes to mind, if you've heard teaching on this before, is that salt is what? Yeah, preservative, right? This is sort of the one that comes up a lot, and I think that this probably is one of the primary images. Dean, go to that slide. Okay, I know that this looks like someone getting communion bread, but that is actually a big old slab of some sort of meat. It's not powdered sugar, that's salt. This is actually what it looks like to salt meat for it to be preserved. It's this idea... I'm sure you understand all the chemistry and biology behind how salt does. If you want to understand it, I can explain it afterwards. I didn't look it up. I don't understand it. I was like, I'm not explaining this. Somehow, what it does is it gets in there, and somehow, some way, it takes some of the yuck that is going to decay the thing, and it takes the yuck on itself, and it keeps the meat doing fine. That's... an interesting, thanks, Luke. Luke likes it. Yeah, that's science, right? That's science. One of you is going to come to me in between the guy and explain it to me, and then 11 will actually have a better explanation. But somehow it preserves the meat from decay. This is very important in the ancient world, right? No refrigeration. And so this was a very important process by which. Notice what the hands are doing there, right? You've got to get the salt into the meat. You've got to get it in there. It's got to actually be applied deep within the structure that it's trying to preserve. Note that, right? That'll preach in just a second. Right, when I think of salt, I think of here in New Jersey, I think of the roads being salted, right? And somehow there's this mystical, magical thing that salt does where you put it on a bunch of ice and... right? Eventually it melts the ice and boom, we can be on our streets, right? Very similarly, in the ancient world, salt just has all kinds of use. In fact, there's an ancient historian called Pliny the Elder, which I don't know, I said with a British accent, but that's how I think of Pliny. He says that you just can't live without salt and light. It's like an offhanded remark he makes in one of his histories. In other words, like, these are just the substance of life. This is what makes life go. I was trying to think of an equivalent. It's a little like us saying, like, hey, you guys are like electricity and running water, right? And you wouldn't want to put too fine a point on either one of those things. It's just, this is what makes life work. It gives life. It makes things go. You are the light of the world. Very similar, right? What does light do? How do you begin to narrow the function of light, right? It functions in darkness so that you can see things. It gives color to the world, right? Like, again, I'm sure you understand how the eye works, right? Where light goes in, and then we see colors that are reflected, right? Like, isn't it something like there aren't colors in the world? Can you tell I'm not a science person? Right? Isn't it like something like there aren't actually colors in the world? Is what our eyes do with it or something crazy? Like Melly's saying yes, so I'm going to say yes, right? Light, you need light for photosynthesis. I know that from science, right? Light for... right? It's a life-giving agent. It does things without which nothing would grow, right? And so there's all of these ways to understand what's going on. I think that the main point that Jesus is trying to make is that his followers are essential to the well-being of this world. We're essential to the kind of life that without God's people present, that there would just be decay and chaos and death. He says, this is who you are. this is who you are. Notice that in both cases, in the first, with the salt, he says, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? And what most scholars say is, this is an absurdity. It's like, if salt isn't salt, then what even is it? So he's emphasizing here, like, there's just something that salt is going to do, right? Like, if you pour too much salt on your turkey, which is almost impossible to do, right? But if you pour too much, you can't be like, well, maybe it won't salt, right? And maybe the salt won't be salting and it'll be fine. It's like, no, it will overwhelm you. That's just what salt is the emphasis in the first one. And then in the second one, he does this whole thing about a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Here he's talking about, particularly, see that image in the top right? In ancient times, just imagine that you're walking down these paths and it's pitch dark. We just can't. Most of us have never probably really been in true total darkness. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. Probably a few of you have that are more outdoorsy types or whatever. But just imagine a world. There's no street lights. There's no city light pollution off in the day. Just pitch dark. And then all of a sudden you're walking and you see something like that image there, which I'm sure is electric light. But imagine, right, all of these lamps in these windows. And all of a sudden you go, civilization, life, respite, shelter. And Jesus is saying there's an impossibility to hide the reality of the distinctiveness of the life that is going on in that place in the ancient world if a city is lit and up on a hill and visible. And then he goes further and he says, nor do you light a lamp and hide it under it. Now, I always thought that it was hide it under a bush. Oh, no. You know what it actually is? Oh, you guys are all church people. At least some of you are, right? Hide it under a bushel. No. No. I'm going to let it shine, right? This also absurd image that, like, you light a candle, immediately put it. Which, what are the two things that are going to happen? The light's going to be hidden. What else happens? It goes out. Why? Science. Because of oxygen. Exactly. It's science day, right? It actually is snuffed out. So it's an absurdity. Why would you light it and then immediately snuff it out? So here he's talking about this idea of hiddenness. Do you hear how under both of these, there is this sense of the thing is just the thing. All it's got to do is be the thing that it is. And that's what he's saying to us. I don't think that what Jesus is getting at here is extraordinary efforts to be salt and light, extraordinary efforts to make ourselves visible. In fact, later in this very sermon, he'll be very suspicious of us when we try and be exceptionally visible, public with our good works. This is just God's people doing God's thing, and there's this impact that gives the world life. Notice also that just like that the hands going into that meat in order that the salt might do its thing deep within where it is, the idea of you are the light of the world, a city set on a hill, a lamp, you don't put it under a basket. It's this idea that light must go toward darkness to truly be what it is. Our most common experience of this in the West is, right, the electricity goes out in a storm or whatever, and all of a sudden your candles become a very important thing. And there's that moment where, boom, the candle goes on. Right now, all we do is we take out our phone and we do our light, right? And there's that moment, though, where, boom, what was invisible becomes visible. And the impact is so immediate and it's so extraordinary. And what's interesting, even about, I was reading one commentator this week who said, what's interesting about light is that five candles in one room are a lot less impactful than one candle in five separate rooms, right? Like it's got to go into darkness for it to have its full effect. It's got to be spread throughout the house. Okay, so do you see, are you beginning to do the work that Jesus wants you to do, right? He's not just going to put these things in our hand and say, this is what I'm getting at here. Hopefully your mind is already going, okay, what does he mean to call us salt and light? He's saying, and I think that the reason why this is such a great transition from the Beatitudes to the rest of the sermon is I think he's saying that those who live in light of these blessings that I've given you, those who see these blessings as preparation for kingdom participation, right? Hopefully that's sort of one of those phrases that worked itself into your mind. Those who live the kind of life that we will now hear over the next several chapters in Jesus' teaching, that this acts as a preservative in the world. It makes homes and classrooms and offices and neighborhoods and teams, it preserves them from the inevitable decay that often happens when just people start peopling together, right? Like, my people are to show up in those spaces and to be a preservative, to bring life, to preserve what is good there, to, yes, ever so gently and ever so humbly, to expose where darkness exists in those places. My people are to be life-giving presences wherever we are, salt and light. And do you notice that, yes, we must go, right? Here's one way to think about this, is you've probably heard the phrase that, especially you church people who answered before, right? You've probably heard the phrase, we're to be in the world, but not of the world. And I would say that in Jesus' teaching, that's almost right, right? We are to be in the world, but not of the world. So we're to be in the world, which is against the isolationist instinct to say, well, let's just huddle up. Let's just protect ourselves from the big, bad world. It's scary out there. They're coming to get us. So let's huddle up, put up walls. No, we're to be in the world, right? The salt isn't going to do its thing if it stays in the salt shaker, right? So we're to be in the world. We are to be massaged into the fabric of this world, so to speak. We're not to be candles that just exist together and light up this one room. And we say, great job, everyone, on Sunday. And then we blow them out and hide them and go back into the world secretly without that identity upon us. We're to be in the world, but not of the world, because we're to be a distinct presence, right? The salt and the light are doing different things than the meat, than the world, than the darkness, right? We have a different kind of, dare I say, calling. We have a different purpose. We have even a different posture, right? And so we're not to take on the properties. This is what Jesus is getting at when he says, but if salt loses its saltiness, right? Like, if somehow the salt didn't have the chemical properties it needed, it would just go into that meat and become part of the meat. If the lamp goes into the darkness and then is quickly snuffed out, guess what? It's just contributing, so to speak, to the darkness. It is not being what it was meant to be. So we're not to be of the world. That's against the conformist kind of instinct. We are to have something different about us. And I think over the next several months through the Sermon on the Mount, we will get clear instruction on what is to be different about us. What this isn't talking about, I think one of the ways to get this all wrong is, like, when Christians go out in the world, we're nicer than most people. That's called moral influence theory. That if we're just nicer than everybody, the world will be a little bit nicer, right? And look, be a little bit nicer. You live in New Jersey. Everyone ain't so nice. Maybe being nice is one of the ways that we can be distinctive. But this is talking about a more robust way of thinking about, man, when I go into my teacher's room, everyone's complaining, right? That could be a place where there's a lot of negativity and pessimism, right? What would it look like not for me to not just be nicer and be like, can I get everyone a slice of cake, right? But instead to say, hey, I was thinking, I know that I'm inclined to complain too. I was thinking, what's something cool that happened today? Like, there's a reason why we all do this, right? That takes a little more boldness than just being nice all the time. But do you hear how that's a preservative? Do you hear how that's salty in that place? Where you go, guys, there's something good here. Like, we all started doing this for a reason, right? You can get crusty over time. There can be mold that starts to be created. Man, what would it look like to be a preservative? And maybe you'll get some looks, and maybe even it'll be one of those times where you feel a little bit of what we talked about last week, some resistance there. But that takes a different kind of courage, right? To in the boardroom, and you're talking about some move, and you realize, I don't know if this is actually ethical. To stick your nose out and to say, hey, there's a lot of darkness in our industry, and we could just be like everybody else, and I can snuff out my candle and say, well, it wasn't really my decision to make. Or I can maybe step in and say, hey, are we sure we want to do that? Is that really best? It might be best for us, but is it best for our customers? Right? That takes a different kind of courage. But to hear how that's a little bit of light in a dark place, right? And look, a lot of times what happens to light in a dark place is it eventually gets snuffed out. But that light is going to shine a little bit. And maybe I think what so often happens when we are salt and light is we give permission for other salt and light to actually function in the way that they were meant to. But a lot of times somebody's got to go first in these places in order for others to say, oh, it's okay to be different here, right? When I think of this, I think of a bunch of things, right? Think of my mom, who died a couple of years back, and she was a pre-K and kindergarten assistant teacher for like 30 years, and she was salt and light, just who she was. She refused to get pessimistic. She stayed optimistic. She loved those kids. She put those kids first. She eventually became the president of her teachers' union. And sometimes she drove those teachers crazy because for her, she was like, well, we're here for the kids. And so whatever we're going to do policy-wise, it better be best for the kids. And they were like, yeah, but us. And she was like, ah, there's a bigger thing going on here. And yet they reelected her again and again and again because she was salt and light in that place. And teachers used to argue, and multiple teachers over the years would tell her, this is the thing, like when she retired, that a bunch of teachers who had worked with her said, is that they said, well, I guess we're all retiring now, because we all used to threaten when she was our assistant. We're like, well, I'm just going to work until you're done, because I'm retiring as soon as you're done, right? Why? Because she was salt and light in those places. And it was more that she was nice, but she was also from New York, born and raised in Jersey, so she was only so nice, right? But she loved those kids, she delighted in those kids, and she was helpful in every way she could be, and then she spoke into the lives of those that she was working with courage when needed. She was salt and light, right? I don't know who you think of. I wonder if you've ever been around someone who gave you permission to step a little bit more into the identity that was already yours, you knew you were just pulling it back. Have you ever had that? Have you ever had a permissive, in the best way, I mean like a really good way, a permissive friend, right? The friend who, when everybody's together and everybody wants to just veg out, is like, hey, we should probably talk about some things. We should probably actually talk about how are we doing, or how are our marriages, or how are our hearts before the Lord, how, right? And you kind of go like, oh, and then you're kind of like, oh, that was a good way to spend a night. I'm glad they're one of my friends, right? And they create a permissive environment to be salt and light, right? I think of on a college campus, so many of you on a college campus, right? And the different places that you inhabit, right? Different social groups that you're in and all of those things. And what I watched in campus ministry over many years was often all it took was one kid. It took one guy on the football team to say, no, we're going to Bible study. That's what we're doing. We're not using lame excuses. And he would go knock on doors and say, we're going because that's just what we're doing. It takes one kid in eating club. I'm talking to Princeton. That was my context, right? It takes one person in eating club to say, no, I'm not doing that during, what was it called? What's the weird thing that you guys do? Not rush, but you call it something else. Yeah, bickering. right? Like, it takes one, and they know what I'm talking about. Right? It takes one to say, no, I'm not doing that, right? And there were years where someone said, I'm not doing that. I will risk not being a part of this moving forward and create a permissive environment where all of a sudden you realize, whoa, right? That was my story. In college, a bunch of knuckleheads start studying the Bible together. We would study the Bible, and then we'd go out and we'd party. And finally, one week, we started saying, I'm not sure I want to do that. And it's like, I don't want to do that either. I feel really guilty. Well, maybe that guilt is like a good thing, and maybe we're not supposed to be doing it. And boom, all of a sudden, this permissive environment, and then we would just sit. And we would no longer do what we used to do on Thursday nights. And it just took one. It just took one to be salt and light, right? You might be surprised, and wherever God has called you to and asked you to steward, you might be surprised what salt and light looks like in that place, right? Like in your neighborhood, right? Can I just say this? I think sometimes we don't feel permission. I'm proud of our church that we stepped up this month in light of all that was happening externally with SNAP benefits going away and all these food banks calling. Like, y'all stepped up. You have no idea. Morgan, I took one of the last shipments of the food this week. And you could tell they were a little like, are you guys going to keep coming? Like, I think we're good, right? That's what we wanted. We wanted to just be like, hey, look, this is who we are in this community. I think of an ancient letter. There's this really cool thing. In the second century, there was this letter discovered. And we know who it's written to. It's written to someone named Diognetus. But we don't know who wrote it. And it's basically a defense of the Christians in the Roman Empire. Clearly, this is like a Roman official who's like, what's the deal with these Christians? I don't know whether to kind of kick them out or whatever. And clearly, this is a Christian writing, and he makes an argument for why the Christians are good. And one of his concluding remarks is, what the soul is in a body, this the Christians are in the world. Isn't that a bar, as the kids say? Right? What the soul is in a body, this the Christians are in the world, right? What gives life? What gives breath? What gives meaning? What gives purpose, right? This is who we are to be and how we are to function, right? And look, let's name it. It's a tragedy that Christians, frankly, Christians of our stripe, right? Like we're evangelicals. I don't know how you feel about that label, but right? Like that label has come to be not a particularly helpful one in all of the political uproar, right? Like do what you will with that label, but like that is not what we're meant to be known as, right? And so let's not be known as that, right? We don't have to associate, right? We don't have, I don't know, many of you have national influence, but like here, let's not be that, right? Like let's be people who actually step in and preserve and give life and shine light, and bring a sense of hopefulness, and show up for needs, and speak into justice causes, and are actually bold enough to say, no, not on our watch, right? This is worth giving your life to. In the world, but not of the world. Here's the part that I think is missing. For the world, right? Yes, we're to be in the world, but not of the world, but for the world, right? This is what that combative sort of posture gets wrong. And I think that this is the one that we're seeing in a national, this idea of like, okay, so we're always ready for a fight. It's like, no, we are for the world. We are for the good, right? I think of one, I forget who I heard say this, but I heard someone say, it's a really weird strategy to hate the people that you're claiming to try and convert, right? And that's so much of what Christians have been known as. It's like we hate those that we claim to have good news for, right? Or, now, that's out there. I think what lives in here is we claim to love those that we aren't willing to speak that good news to, right? We tend a little conformist. We tend a little isolationist. I'm talking to our people here at Jake's Well, right? Like if we love, yes, we can't hate, but if we love, we've also got to speak and bring the uniqueness of the light. Do you hear what Jesus says at the end of this passage? He doesn't say, let your light so shine so that people might like you more, so that people might see you as the right kind of Christian. He says, in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Really like what Scott McKnight, who's a great New Testament scholar, I really like how he articulates the difference between this and what Jesus will warn us against later, where he says things like, don't be like those obnoxious people who pray in a way that everybody is impressed with. Don't be like those who announce how much they're giving and want all the accolades for their generosity. He's like, do these things in secret. So how do we understand that in contrast to let your light so shine that they might see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven? He says the difference is at the level of intent. In the latter, the intent is to be noticed and congratulated by others as someone who is righteous or pious. While here, the act is to be done publicly, but in order to mediate God's redeeming presence in Christ and thus to glorify God. Then he says the paradox is deeper in the brutal reality of Bonhoeffer. You know Bonhoeffer? I talk about Bonhoeffer a lot. My little guy's reading a little, the little comic graphic novel. He was reading a graphic novel about Bonhoeffer. It delights me. He's like, this guy's really cool. I'm like, yes, let's go. Paradox deeper. In the brutal reality of Bonhoeffer, who's a great theologian in Nazi Germany, stood against that regime. He asked, is the cross not something which became outrageously visible in complete darkness? In other words, if we are really in the world but not of the world for the world, if that is really our intent, we will find ourselves in dark places in a way that it's hard to not be visible, right? Like a lot of times we want to be visible where it's comfortable, right? We want our own people to applaud us. But if we're really going into these places, I wrestled with whether to share the story, and I made sure that I could. But I always think of something that Morgan, who's our director of operations, something that she said in an offhanded way a while ago. She, her husband Chris, had won one of these trips that companies give where you go to this outrageously nice thing. She wanted me to be very clear. They won this trip. And they were sent to Miami to this outrageously nice hotel, and they were looking for somewhere, I think, to watch a football game. And like the hotels were so swanky and everything. And they just sort of kept moving away from the part of Miami that they were in. And they eventually got to a bar, and she wants you to know she was way more comfortable in this bar. But as they went down the blocks, right, things got less glitzy, and the actual reality, some of the difficult realities of every city became more visible. She made this comment, and it just stuck with me. She said, it made me realize that so often what wealth does is it insulates you from the suffering of the world. And I thought, whoa. And I think we need to be very careful, right? And look, some of you are in profound need as you sit here. And for that, like, we want to show up for you as salt and light. Some of you have tremendous opportunity. Some of, right, like we are an exceptionally well-educated church and all of these things. But you have to ask the question, what am I leveraging that for? Am I primarily leveraging it so that I might be protected from the reality of this world, so that I might be as comfortable as I can be, right? And Jesus would whisper and say, that's salt losing its saltiness. Is it so that I might be hidden and not have to see and confront what others are actually going through? Jesus will say, that's not a city set on a hill. And what he would say is he wouldn't condemn you for that. He would say, that's just not who you are. That's not who I am recreating you to be. You know, who is in the world, not of the world, for the world, more fully and completely than Jesus? That is who he was. He came into the world. Do you know how insane that is? Do you know how crazy it is that that is the basis of our faith, right? Like, if you don't know much about Christianity, that's where the whole thing, that's what it all comes down to, is that Jesus, God, like the creator of the universe, the source of all things, became flesh. He came in the world. He was not of the world, though. He was God incarnate. But amazingly, check this one out, he was for the world. He came into it not to condemn it, but to actually save it. We are just following in the footsteps of Jesus, becoming what he became so that we might finally become who we were always meant to be. That's the good news, guys. I think of something, thinking of how to land this whole idea of like, Jesus isn't commanding us to do something so that we might earn something. He's asking us to step into who he has already recreated us to be. And I thought of the story of Jacob's well, the story that our church's name comes from in John 4. One of the most interesting things that Jesus says in that is, I won't retell the whole story, but after he's had the interaction with the woman that the passage is most known for, his disciples come back and they went into town to get food, and they see that he's talking to a woman, and they don't say anything because they're like, ooh, he does his own thing, this guy. We're figuring it out. Like, don't ask questions, right? And then they say, Jesus, you should probably eat. Like, he was already weary. That's how the passage starts. He's already weary. And they're like, you should eat. And then he says the craziest thing. Remember what he says? He says, I have food that you don't know about. And they're like, and they literally, I love it. It's so honest. They're like, did somebody else bring him food? Like, did he call like DoorDash? Like, what's this food? And he says, my food is to, remember what he says? Does anybody remember it? It's to do the will of the Father. What Jesus is saying is that there is a kind of obedience that fills. Whereas we often think of obedience as that which draws from us, as that which requires something of us, as that which depletes. And Jesus, who is physically weary, says even on that level, right? He's not just talking spiritual. He's saying even on that level, there is a kind of obedience that we step into and we find ourselves fuller. We find ourselves nourished. We find ourselves energized. You know what this feels like, right? Do you know what this feels like? It feels like that thing that you know the Lord wants you to do, and you say, but it's going to require too much of me. And then you step into it and you say, why did I wait so long? There's a kind of obedience that fills. And that's why he doesn't say, thou shalt be salt, thou shalt be light. He says, you are, you are, you are. And when you step into that, you will find that there is a sense of fullness. You will find that there is a sense of not depletion, but of a kind of completion, right? This is what Jesus is calling us to in the sermon. He's saying, I want you to be complete. I want you to be who you were created to be. And it's going to always feel like sacrifice on the front end, but it will be life on the other end. And then he goes to the cross and says, what looks like death is actually the greatest means to life. And then he says, if anyone would come after me, this is the rhythm, this is the pattern. It will look like death. But death in Jesus always leads to life because he is the one who is so perfectly in the world, but not of the world, for the world, that he rescued it and now gives it a new way of being, brings life, brings what we need to have preserved in us, right? That the Spirit comes and preserves life in us, and then he calls us to follow him into that amazing reality. And so we come to this table, right, to be nourished. To be nourished, confident, right? That Jesus will sufficiently give us what we need to be salt and light. And that at this table, right? At this table is bread broken by Jesus. He says, my suffering so that you might know wholeness. Then he takes wine that was at the table and he says, this is my blood poured out for the forgiveness of your sins. In other words, for the forgiveness of the ways in which you have fallen short of being salt and light. I'll cover that. I got you, right? And he says, come with an awareness that this is just a foretaste of what awaits us as we step ever more into kingdom participation with him as we await that day when we will step in fullness. And so how we do it here at Jacob's Well is we come down these two aisles. There's bread on the outside, a gluten-free option here. There's wine and there's juice that are labeled. You go ahead and take the bread, dip it, take it, and then go out the sides. If you're not a follower of Jesus, man, we would invite you to bow the knee to the one who is in this world, but wasn't of this world, which is such good news that he's not of this world, because he's not just one of us, right? He was distinct from us, but he was for us. And he is your hope of life, of preservation, of what your soul actually longs for. And so we would call you to bow the knee to him this morning. If you do that, your words aren't as important, but we just love the invitation. Make your first act of faith to come to this table and then tell one of us what you've done so that we can give you a sense of what's next from there. If you're not there yet, Scriptures are very clear that you honor him most by just considering what you've heard. So I'm going to invite the band up. They're going to play for a little bit. You can do whatever business you need to do with the Lord and then come when you're ready. Let me pray for us. Lord Jesus, thank you that before calling us to be salt and light, you were salt and light. And you remain those with and for us. God, I pray that that reality would just go ever deeper into our lives, Lord. That you are the means by which darkness has been dispelled from our lives. You are the means by which life has come where only there was a tendency toward death and decay in us. And then, Lord, call us out as your people to be that on behalf of our neighbors, of the world around us, of a world that you love so deeply, Lord. I pray that this community, that we individually, but Lord, I think the emphasis here is that we collectively as a community would be known as a people that are for Middlesex County, Mercer County, for these campuses, for these neighborhoods, Lord. And God, help us to know what that looks like in each of our lives, but also corporately. Lord, thank you for the ways that you're pushing us and challenging us to be that. Lord, I pray that even right now you would convict our hearts where maybe we are withholding that, nervous to step into that identity. And Lord, that you would give us the boldness to step into it and that you would meet us even this week as we do that. Maybe it's at Thanksgiving tables. Maybe it's as we return to homes and to families, Lord, that you would call us into that, Lord, whatever that would look like. Lord, I just hand that over to your Spirit to bring conviction where that is needed, to bring encouragement where it is needed. Lord, now as we come to this table, meet us in your grace. We pray this in Jesus' name.